Good afternoon. This is the final lecture of the season, so I guess for some of you it's taken forever to get here, and for some other people it came sooner than expected. At any rate, we have a couple of things to do. First of all, on behalf of computer science, I want to thank you for that excellent picnic. I know at least a few of you showed up, and all of you helped pay for it, which was good. I think, after all, you're the workers. You provide the product that earns the money that pays for the catering and supplies and everything. So it was an excellent picnic, and the visitors were very impressed. I took a group of staff members finally over to deep space, and we finally saw the thing, and whoa, another situation there. And we ran into one poor fellow. I don't know if it's his definition of heaven or hell, but his job apparently is to vacuum the entire area out, and we asked him, and he did it. Apparently he does it every night. So, I mean, is that eternal torture, or is it just, you know, the world's sweetest little job? You just vacuum out this huge area and you're done. Just by way of stats, does anybody know how many people at seats? I know they say you have your monthly meetings here, which means it must be at least 4,000 or 5,000. Does anybody know the official number? Like, excuse me? Over 10,000, 11,500. Wow. Did you ever consider getting your own NBA team or something there? You know? The epic epochs or something, or whatever you call it. But anyway, so let's go over what we're going to do for the rest of this week. Today, what I'm going to do is we're going to do a little multitasking. I'm going to return P4, the sheets for P4 for those who haven't picked it up as yet. And we're also going to have to do course evaluations. It turns out that the department, in fact, maybe you can help on this. I ended up getting assigned the old-fashioned course evaluations, the one you probably took way back when, paper, you know, and filling, you know, the little grid on the side, you know, almost kind of like the old SATs from way back when, or GREs. And the thing is, we've been thinking about and trying experimentally to go over to an online system, as you might imagine. But the trouble with an online system is, how do you get people to, for most of the class, to go and bother to do it? There's been a couple of schools of thought, maybe you have the same problem with your customers. One is the hammer. Say, we're going to watch you, and if you don't hand one in, we're going to take 5 points off your grade or whatever it might be. The other one would be that we're going to have some kind of drawing, and you're automatically entered, and you're going to win a $100 savings bond or whatever it happens to be. The only trouble then is when my cousin Bill wins the award, they're going to be a little suspicious about how we rigged it all up. So if you folks have a similar problem, you have any good ideas, clearly we ought to be going to an online approach, but like any sort of survey, unless you get a meaningful response, it really doesn't help a whole lot. It's in these sort of things you typically get people who really have an axe to grind. They either really love the course or they hated the course, and they're going to make it their eternal mission to make sure the individual in question never survives to do another course. So anyway, let me start these around. We even brought the sacks of little pencils. We have an employee whose job is to create little sacks of pencils. So let me just start these, just grab one and grab some pencils. If you have your own pencil, those work too. But they gotta be a number two, can't be number one. Excuse me. Spring is in the air. If anybody wants to keep a pencil as a souvenir, I won't count how many I get back. You've been doing all the supplies, so we'll let the university pony up for one. Sack. For those who just are arriving, we have a course eval that's floating around. Try to grab one of those, and or even pencils if you need them. I also have the P4 sheets. Again, some people have picked it up, but many of you haven't. let me remind you that if you get a grade less than what you expected, it may be that you didn't do badly, but rather you and the TA were a little out of sync with respect to how things were graded. And particularly, he had a couple of cases where he grossly misgraded the project because he expected that if you found an error, your P4 would error out as part of termination. So his model was run the test. If it sees no errors at all, it exits cleanly. If it sees some number of errors, it prints out messages which may or may not be easy to read because they'll be highly variable from person to person. But then he'd look at the fact that you errored out, that is, you did an exit with a return code, and that was an indication that you did not exit cleanly. And some people did different counters and so on. It was a minor thing, and he fixed it, and he regraded, and he got a much more acceptable grade. From 1 to 2? Some people got like 1 or 2, and doubling is not that much. Doubled is to nearly 100? Almost, yeah. This was a real hard one to get 100 on because just so many different tests. This situation, you know, that there's just like so many laws. You know, if a cop wants to get you, he'll get you on something or other. As if you don't break one law, you'll break another. So, Carl? And Josh Chenard. Either Ryan Colapini or Karsten Quinlan. Clark Downham. Lorianne Drager. Sam Felt. Timothy Fairisen. You're Felt? Yeah. Benjamin Fleming. Mandon Mason or Brandon Frank. Dan Gerber. Ji Yinsheng, GE. Osama, Ahmad Osama. No, he missed today. Jacob Harbour or Grant Gentoff Johnson. Sure. Michael Hudson. Stuart Isaac. Dustin Carrolls with a K. Susanna Kelly with a K. John Liu, Tim Lohr, Dustin Maiden, Luke Matthews, Maiden or Matthew? Okay. Okay, Luke Matthews, Lynn McCormick, or Corwin Lawrence. Andrew Maranovich. Nicholas Mollick. Robert Owen. Trey Pick. Mr. Posner. You're in the wrong spot. First come, first served, I guess. Catherine Pracknow. Malcolm Reed. Patrick Robichaud. Michael Santana or Allison Kador. You're not Allison, right? Okay, got that right, okay. Nicholas Schober. Emma Schultz. Ryan Smith. Wesley Smolta. What is it? I got to get that right. Say that again. Shamatula. Oh, I'll never get that one right. Drabeck Thompson or Thompson Drabeck? Probably. Joel Thompson. Mr. Vempathy. Chris Viernig. David Whalen. Michael White. Daniel Wilmer. Kwan Yin, Y-I-N. And Daniel Yogurst. And Mr. Zun Zhao, Z-H-A-O. Okay. Yeah, you might be. Just there we go. Okay, I'll pick up the course evals at the first break. So let me go over what's remaining here. Our first sitting of the final is tomorrow. The format will be, it's only going to be on type checking and code generation. The form will be four questions out of more than four. Actually, in tomorrow's exam, it's six, so you get choice of four out of six. And I've reserved time so that we'll have time to ask questions about old exams or questions that have come up on how you might do this or that if it's an issue. So could I just have a showing of hands of roughly how many people plan to do the first, just so I know how many exams to run? Okay, I count about 15. Because most of you apparently will be taking the second exam, surprise, surprise, I'll have an office hour on Thursday. Project 5 is due on Friday, but you can actually take a few late days if you need to over the weekend. So we'll have an office hour on Monday. That will be either to cover exam questions or final project issues. The final accept date for the project is Tuesday the 12th. That's just to give the TA a fair chance to do grading on all the hand-ins. Our second final offering will be a week from today in this room, 5:30 to 7:30, and I'm planning to get the final grades out probably the 15th or the 16th. 15's a Friday, 16's a Saturday, depending on how fast grading goes and any other issues. And what will happen is I'll send an email to Piazza that the grades are out. And normally, I put final grades in through MyUW, and I believe it comes, you use your version of MyUW, I think, to check your course grades. So those should be out almost instantaneous once I enter them, and you'll be able to know how you've done. But I should say, don't overly worry. Most of you are doing quite well, and I expect most, if not all of you, will get the requisite B or BC that you need to continue in the program. And things are seem to be working out fine in this way in terms of how well people are doing. And as I understand it, you just need to do a course this summer and then another one this fall, and you'll have your five courses and be ready to get your certificate. Is that correct? So that's pretty cool. I mean, that means by the end of the calendar year, you'll have a degree, and that's a pretty good turnaround, pretty good speed, particularly with the company paying the bill for it all, which is rarer and rarer these days. I may be around in the fall. It's not totally decided yet, but things have gone so well that they decided to do another cohort. It is another group, mostly, again, of, I think, Epic employees, and I'll be doing the 367 probably, the first of the five courses for that cohort. So at this point, we'll actually have two groups going. You'll be doing your final course in the fall, and then the next cohort will be doing their initial course. And we'll see how many times this continues. And, of course, at some point, we're going to open it up to other folks who outside of Epic who also want and need to do the program. So what I'll be doing today, and now we got things passed out, is I've got a little bit of final lecturing going on a couple of interesting topics. And I know some of you are planning to do a master's degree, and there actually is a following course to 536, and it's a fairly interesting course. Most of you won't take it, but let me just mention it in passing. You say, well, I built a whole compiler. What else could I do? And it turns out that there's a lot of more advanced theory about analyzing programs and optimizing programs. And some of it seems fairly theoretical, but it really can have some fairly practical advantages. Some of you are too young, but I think most of you remember to the bad old days of Windows systems where blue screens were very common. I mentioned that I had the misfortune years ago to have Microsoft ME. That was around the millennium, so I guess around the year 2000. And that thing blue screened like a son of a gun all the time. And more modern Windows systems don't blue screen nearly as much. I think, you know, they're probably as reliable as Macintosh systems, which have an underlying Unix operating system. And the reason they used a blue screen, as some of you may know, some of you may not, was that Windows is a very open system. And they had a real vulnerability, and that was that you could attach your own equipment, your own peripherals, to a Windows-based system. And all those hardware devices, as you may recall, have a special piece of software called a driver. And the driver interacts with the operating system and the hardware to convey information back and forth. But normally, the Windows people could not control that. It was rather much like if you have a medical clinic and you have sort of a walk-in situation where any guy who wants to be a surgeon can be it. So I need an appendectomy. Oh, well, I'm interested, and let's do it. And a guy walks in, and he cuts and pastes, or cuts and staples, or I guess these days, and maybe you survive, and maybe you don't. If you survive, that's the things that kind of worked. And if you didn't survive, those are the blue screen. I guess you bleed out, and you turn blue or something. And that was, and it seems funny, but that's actually what would happen because Windows would be forced to insert software provided by some hole-in-the-wall vendor, possibly, and gosh knows what it would do. So actually, some people on our faculty, Professor Tom Reps and Susan Horowitz, who some of you may know passed away just this last year. She's an excellent teacher. She might have been teaching this course if things had been otherwise. And an excellent researcher. And she also helped develop a system called SLAM. And what SLAM would do is actually take Windows, take a driver, and analyze possible execution paths, and you're getting a little flavor of what that's like, to find out if bad things could happen. And bad things would happen, for example, if you didn't follow the locking protocol properly. When you studied databases, you knew it was very important. Every time you lock something, you better unlock it. And since a lot of your work has to do with database-related things, that's kind of a fundamental thing. And there'd be certain paths where you could, for example, be accessing data that hadn't been properly reserved, and therefore you get race conditions. That would be why sometimes something would crash and otherwise it wouldn't. It's just luck of the draw. Sometimes somebody would be doing something that interfered with you and other times not. So that's the sort of things that the more advanced theories analyze, and they had some very practical results. And if you're interested in that sort of thing, either here or some other place, there are more advanced courses. But the fundamental is you're just at the point now where you've got a real compiler right from the start. Scanner, parsing, type checking, AST building, and finally code generating, and it's all working. And I think that's a cool thing, because now, even if the programs still don't work right, you kind of still now understand what they're doing while they're not working right. And that's kind of a relief. It's not evil spirits or anything like that. It's usually just bad programming, which is unfortunately all too common. So let me first ask any questions on Project 5 or anything that we'd like you to do. We'll do the exams a little bit later. But I've got a couple of topics I want to get into, and then we'll have time, and maybe even we'll get done early, if depending on how much interest there is. Yeah. We were not going to do, you can have a copy of our type checker if you want, although there was something going around that there was even a flaw in the type checker that I was sending around that had to be fixed. And it's a situation that means, you know, don't even trust your own code. That's all these cases. But what happened is we're not going to have any programs that have type errors in them. So the only thing that could get you wrong is if your type checker didn't set type and kind and the so-called ID info, which is a pointer back to the identifier information that the symbol table would have held. If you, that stuff is all working. Right. Well, if you want, you can just send me email and I'll send you a copy of my solution. Check that one, the one note. Does anybody remember what the title of it was? But it was the one that had to do with labels not having their ID info properly set for labels on loops, and that's just a sort of silly little thing that sometimes slips through. Well, there's a fix floating out there, so you're welcome to do it. I didn't post the solutions to four or any others because I have a phobia about putting solutions to assignments on the internet. And, you know, there's always web crawlers and all that. You put it out today, and it's in general circulation tomorrow and in future. You know, I don't want it ever get to the point where you're taking a course and all you have to do is download solutions, even if it's not the exact solution, a partial solution. So if I send it to you individually, it's not on the internet, hopefully. And that's why I'm doing it that way. So if you'd like a copy, you're welcome to get one. And again, read that fix if you have that problem with the label and the ID info for labels on loops. Other issues? Okay, we've got a couple of other topics, and these are interesting things because a lot of the stuff we've been doing is pretty vanilla. And what I'll be touching on today and what an advanced course, a graduate course would do about some of the more subtle aspects of understanding programs, analyzing them, and improving them. And let me get my screen back to life. Okay, and this is jump code. And again, this is one of those things where a lot of what we've done, you're smart people and you could have figured it out on your own given enough time and enough effort. But there are certain concepts which might not have ever occurred to you just because they are outside the box, as people like to say, terminology-wise. And I think jump code fits into that category. And there's a related concept called short-circuiting that fits with jump code very nicely. Normally, short circuits are bad. That's when your device goes up in a puff of smoke. But short-circuiting is more or less like taking a shortcut. So instead of thinking it's short-circuiting, call it short-cutting. That's not really a proper term, perhaps, but we could do it, of a way to evaluate just enough of an expression to get the answer, and not necessarily the whole thing. And as we'll see, that's not just an optimization. In some cases, it's really quite mandatory, and sometimes programmers fully expect to have that mode of evaluation. Turns out we're not doing it as the default, but it's still something that you ought to know about. So what jump code is all about is let's kind of review what we had done for a simple conditional. And this is an example of something where it works right. And if now we're getting to the point where this code starts to be modestly readable, that's great. There's certainly something where now you've started generating enough and looking at enough J files that it's not entirely foreign. So the sort of situation is one of these oddities. If you're in a foreign country or something and kind of know the language, after a while, you actually start to understand what they're saying and say, hey, you know, I'm starting to fit in. Some of the subtleties, maybe not, but the other stuff. So this is what our intention had been. And in this statement, we evaluate a Boolean. And in our simplistic model, evaluating means put it on the operand stack. False is zero, one is true. So in the case of a Boolean variable, that's easy because that's how we represent true and false. So we do a load from local two. In that case, let's assume that's B. Just happens that way. So remember, locals are assigned these index numbers or offsets into the frame, starting with zero, and this one just happens to have two. So it loads it onto the stack. If EQ says if equal to what? Well, what's the magic number? Usually it's zero. So if it's equal to zero, which is false, go to L1. L1 labels the else part. So an if statement says if true, do the then, if false, do the else. If it doesn't branch, it so-called falls through. It means continues normal sequential execution. So in this case, there's something that a version of load constant called iconst underscore one, that is push the constant one. The reason I have this oddity here is I actually stole this code from a version of a Java compiler just to make sure that the code I was talking about was really the code Java would use. So make sure that we are consistent. And if I was saying, here's the good and bad that Java does, let's be honest about it. And it happens that the JVM has alternative codes. So one of the things it has is bytecodes are variable length. This is one of the big debates in computer architecture, is that should some instructions be small and others large because some have small amount of information and others have more. So this is the case of a very small opcode, is it doesn't have any operands at all. It's all wired into the opcode. That's why if you look at iconst, it has an underscore one. So it says push a very popular number. What are popular numbers? Are probably zero and one for sure. So it says in a single bytecode, go ahead and push the constant one onto the stack. I could have done LDC, load constant one. Then it takes two operands and it's a little bit bigger. So the thinking was, variable size opcodes make code smaller and maybe make it faster. Not everybody agrees with that. There are many computer architects that argue that fixed length instructions, be they 32 bits or maybe even longer, are the better way of doing it. In part because you can easily predict ahead where the next instructions are. One of the liabilities about variable length opcodes is if I have a highly parallel machine, I may want to try to do the current instruction and possibly the next one if they're independent. That's called instruction level parallelism, ILP, and it's very important. But if I can't find the second and third and fourth instruction easily, that gets much harder. If everything's the same length, then it's easy. I know this much is the first instruction, that's the second, and so on. So in this case, we're doing what the JVM allows us to do. So this is pushing constant one, and that's part of the A gets one, and then it does an I store into local variable one, which we'll assume is A. And at L2, it does iconst 0, again, a very small opcode, to do a very common operation, put 0 on the operand stack, and then store it away into variable 1. So this is a pretty clean code. It turns out, was it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 instructions. And that's a pretty reasonable code for what is a conditional instruction. It is a main operand and then two substatements to be executed. Turns, however, that if we do something just a tad more complex in JVM land, the code gets way nastier. And this is roughly the code you would generate, and you can actually try if your compiler's at the stage where it's pretty much done, try and see what you get for this. But basically, the reason for this is the way we do comparisons in JVM is by a conditional branch. The JVM designers did that, and when we look at this code, it looks like they were pretty stupid. But it's not at all that they were stupid. It's rather that we are not as advanced as they were, and we don't yet know the sort of tricks they had in mind. So in this case, we're doing it the backwards way, the bass-ackwards way, if you want to say that. So in this case, what we do is we load two operands, that'd be F and G, and do this fancy if thing. So it says, if doing an integer compare for equality, they are equal, jump to L1. And in that particular case, L1... It is a situation there where it's going to push the one onto the stack. And so what it's doing is essentially setting up, if they're equal, I'm going to put true on the stack. Otherwise, it falls through. That must mean they're unequal. I put 0 on the stack and go to L2. So up to L2, I've done nothing but put a 0 or a 1 on the stack. But here's the silly part. What am I putting on the stack for? So I can do a conditional branch, a la the previous slide. So starting at L2, I say, if the top of the stack, that Boolean I just computed, is false, I go to L3, which is the else part. Otherwise, I fall through and assign 1 to variable 1, which is A. Otherwise, I've gone to L3, and I push 0 on the stack and store that into variable 1. So this is much longer code, and it's just unsatisfying. I did conditional branch to put something on the stack to do a conditional branch. It certainly seems to be more complex than it needs to be. And the reason for it is that we had the standard way of thinking, evaluating a Boolean expression. Get me a Boolean value sitting somewhere on the operand stack or possibly in memory. But it turns out we can do something different, namely have something called jump code. And in jump code, what we'll do is we won't say I want to put a 0 or 1 on the stack. I'll say you're going to evaluate some code and you're conditionally going to go to one label or another. We may go to a label if I figure out something is true, and if it's false, we'll fall through. Or I can do the other version and say if it's false, I'll go someplace and fall through if it's true. So there's actually two versions of jump code, and it turns out we can generate either flavor we want. So I guess it's rather much like in some countries you drive on the left-hand side of the street, and in the other case you drive on the right-hand side of the street. Except I guess if you're a biker in Madison, then you drive dead center down the middle of the street, making sure that everybody gets discombobulated. So let's see how this works. It turns out that it looks odd. And again, the hard part is, the part you might not have ever thought about is, you don't need to actually have a value in hand to know what the value is, just in case of a Boolean. You can know where the value is by just being here or being somewhere else. And that's really what we want in an if-then and also in a while loop or anything that's got a conditional. We say, if this thing is true, I want to be in the then part. If it's false, I want to be in the else part. Or in a while loop, it says, if it's true, I want to be in the loop body. If it's false, I want to be past the loop body, exiting the loop to the succeeding statement, the succeeding code. So if we can code it that way, we'll get what we really want. It turns out that conditional Boolean expressions are usually used to control ifs or whiles. And since that implies jumping anywhere, jumping to the then or the else part, or jumping in, keeping in the loop or getting out of the loop, why don't we go with the flow and actually generate code in such a way that we have a position, a true label or a false label, as our intent of evaluation rather than putting something on the stack. So let's take a look at that. And here's the alternative that we had previously. It says that if I want to do jump code, I can go ahead and actually load those two values and then do a compute not equal that goes to label L1. So in this case, L1 is the false label. And if this thing is false, I'm going to go there. Because remember, we were doing equal, and now we're doing the complement of it. So it's the way we do this is every Boolean expression, every Boolean operator, I should say, relational operator, has a complement. The complement of equal is not equal. The complement of less than is greater than or equal. The complement of greater is less than or equal. So there's 6 different operators, and they each have a complement. So if I want to do a conditional branch on a true, so-called true jump code, I do the conditional branch if the relation I want is true. Otherwise, I do its complement. And if the complement turns out to be true, that means the original relation was false. So I can have my flavor. Sometimes one is better and sometimes the other. And I'll explain how we choose those a bit down the line. So all of a sudden, here's the code we had on the previous slide in jump code form. I'm going to say the situation here where I'm going to load the two variables and do a compare not equal. So in this case, if they're not equal, I'm going to go to label L1. Why L1? Because it says if the expression is false, I'm going to go to the then part. I'm sorry, the else part. And if it's true, I want to fall through to the else part. So this code is much tighter. I load compare, and then I'm immediately in the then part, branch around the else part, or I branch to the else part and fall through. So this is about as good a code as you could expect, way better than we had previously. But notice I never, ever put a value, true or false, on the operand stack, or even, for that matter, anywhere in memory. It's rather than if it's true, I end up at one label, namely the L1, and if it's false, I go down and do the other direction, which is an implicit label after the compare, the so-called fall through. So as I said, I can have two versions, jump if true or jump if false. How do you determine which one you want? Well, normally you look at the code. Let's do an if statement first of all, and then we'll do a while. The if statement says if something is true, I want to execute the then part. Normally the then part's generated right after the condition, so that sort of begs for a fall through. If the expression is false, I want to go to the else part, which is somewhere placed further down. So I want to branch if false. So I evaluate the expression in such a way that I'll do a conditional branch to a given label, which will be on the else part if it's false, and I'll fall through to the then code, which will be generated right after this condition in jump code form was evaluated. How about a while loop? The while is normally tested up top, so it says while true. So in this particular case, if it's true, I want to fall into the body. If it's false, I want to branch out. So in this case, you do a branch if false. Turns out there are other kinds of loops. I've got some paper here, so let's dig that out and do some others. Besides the while loop, it can have something called a repeat until. So repeat until some Boolean. And you don't use this as much, but there is a version of this certainly in C and C++. This is a good form for where you know you've got to do at least one iteration and maybe some additional iterations. So the conditional is not even tested until the bottom. So in this particular case, it says repeat, and it says until this case goes true. So in this particular case, situation, if it's true, I want to fall through, and if it's false, I want to jump to the top label. So there'd be another case there where I want to do a branch on false, that if it's false, this condition hasn't been met yet, I can go ahead and go up. And you can imagine other situations where I repeat until the negation is holds, in which case I just flip the then and false components. So this works on a variety of conditionals that are available. So this by itself is nice because it fits in with the JVM code nicely. But it turns out it also sets up another unexpected optimization, and that's something called short-circuiting. It happens the way we've been doing Boolean operators, that's and or, is actually not the way C or C++ or Java do it, because they do this optimization of short-circuiting because it's expected. It turns out that it's handy in some cases, and in some cases it's more efficient, because what short-circuiting does is allow you to bail out of an expression before all the operands are fully evaluated. The way we've been doing it is the very straightforward way. So if you had A and B or C or D, we'd evaluate A, push it on the stack, evaluate B, push it on the stack, and then do an and operation on the Boolean values. And that's fine. That's the way you're doing it, and it's correct under our specifications. C or D would push C, push D, again, 0 or 1, true or false, and then do an OR operation, leaving the OR on the stack. What short-circuiting says is that if you think about something like, well, let's first do the and. There are cases where A does not have to be evaluated at all. In fact, if I know A is false, I never have to touch B at all. And I'll show you on a slide or two why that's valuable. But in this particular case, B might be a function call, for example, something that's expensive. And the reason I can do this is I know that false and anything is false. So immediately I know that A is false. For example, if I'm controlling an if statement, and I said if A and B. If I evaluate B and I find it's false, the whole expression must be false, and I can jump to the else part immediately, never have to pay the price of evaluating B. Sometimes I want to avoid B for efficiency's sake. Other cases would be the situation there that B is valid only if it's the case that I know that A is true and B has a chance as a necessity to being evaluated further. So in particular, if we look at the very last line there, we redefine A and B not to be the Boolean A and B, but be the so-called short-circuited version that say if A is true, then we got to look at B, otherwise we immediately go to false. So, and you can imagine this kind of fits into jump code pretty nicely, because now if we do jump code well, and it turns out it can be very nicely done, I can get around B. So again, think of it as short-circuiting as bad terminology. Think of it as taking a shortcut. and many of you driving in, I guess, I don't know, is there a traffic jam in the morning when people are coming into work? There certainly seems to be one when people are leaving in the evening, but when I'm coming in, second shift. But certainly situations where if something's pretty busy, it's going there. I know that some of the faculty yesterday were saying they came in on 151 and hit a lot of traffic. And I kind of smiled because around rush hour, I never touch 151. So what I usually do is come in PD and then go down County M, and that gets me pretty close to the building. And if I knew exactly, I always forget which road it is. If I went down PD further, or some road, you probably know what it is, many of you take it, that if I went on there, it would take me right to the north end of this campus. But it isn't easy to recognize. The M is easy to recognize. It's got a big traffic signal and cross traffic and everything, so it's easier. So although we call short-circuiting, think of it as short-cutting. And if I could redo the terminology, I think that would be probably better. And that means in some cases I can shortcut the evaluation of two terms into one. And it even gets nicer when we have a more complex expression, as I'll show you in a bit. So we can do a similar thing with OR. So I say if C or D. In this case, if I know C is true, remember the definition of OR is true or anything is true. So immediately that I know C is true, if I'm in an if statement, I can immediately go then to the then part. So here's a case where I'd want to have a branch if true evaluation. Say if I know it's true, I can get out of this expression straight away and go to the then part because D setting is not going to change it. True or anything is true, so the anything being D can be avoided. If it's false, then I still have a chance. I then go to D, so well, now D is true. In this case, if it's true, I want to do the then part. If it's false, I want to go ahead and go to the else part. In this case, I'd probably do a branch if false. So if D is false, I go to the else part. Otherwise, I'd fall through into the then part. So it seems complex, but once you get the little details straight, it turns out very nicely. And this just repeats what I just said. So let's look at a complex example. I think this is a case where the example comes out very nicely. And I think at this stage, most of you are pretty much done with your projects. But if you decide, oh man, I need some last minute extra credit to bail me out of P4 or something, and don't worry about P4, it's not as bad as you might fear it was in that situation. Here's a situation where doing Booleans as short circuit rather than as Boolean values is a great extra credit because you're really doing what real compilers would prefer to do. I didn't introduce this because I think conceptually treating Boolean operators the same as arithmetic operators or relational operators is more uniform. And whenever you do something initially, it's always the KISS principle. What does the KISS principle stand for? It's not the Valentine's Day type KISS. We got to be polite here. So it's keep it simple, students. It's only if you're in the military, it's keep it simple, stupid, and then maybe something stronger than that. But it's really a hard thing that we as computer scientists, particularly, and you're all comparatively young, but you probably get a little bit of the old fogeyism too, where it's hard to change, get a feeling of changing realities. In the old days, for me, memory was pretty scarce, and therefore doing things to save memory seemed like a cool idea. Now memory is much more readily available, so it's not as big an issue. But you get pushed back to the fact that now you have computer programs and everything. Turns out my toothbrush has a computer in it. How do I know that? Well, I don't know for sure, but it's one of these fancy sonic things that my dentist talked me into that has all these little settings. You set one, and the bristles go this way, and if you do another, the bristles go that way, and you can have it for a short run or a medium run or a longer run. And deep down, there's some sort of little logic in there, that's doing this sort of thing. If this is true and this is true, run the motor this way, otherwise run it that way. So you can imagine that whatever computer they have in a little toothbrush doesn't have gigabytes of memory. At least I hope it doesn't. Maybe, whatever the price of memory's gone down, it does. But in those sort of situations, keeping memory down is an issue. So it's always this sort of situation. Do I keep something simple? And therefore, it's easier to understand, less likely to have errors, but it's less efficient in some ways. Or I do something that's a tad more complex, but it's a better way of solving it. And I think this is one of those unending problems that you as software designers will have. How do you balance out the need to keep it simple and easy to maintain and easy to understand and less likely to have errors versus something that may need to be much more complex, much faster. And really kind of as a buildup, you know, the course that's being taught this summer, and the course on algorithms, really gets into a lot of that. It turns out that in many cases, the obvious way of solving a problem with a data structure works, but it may not work well enough to actually be used in practice. It may turn out that there are less obvious algorithms that can be proved, really theoretically, to be much faster. And certainly, I don't want to steal Dieter's thunder, but there's the old issue of n squared versus n log n. And many algorithms have this sort of property. If you took, for example, when you took 367, I'm almost certain that you did sorting. And once I prepare for my class, I know my people will do sorting. And it turns out there are two kinds of sorting algorithms. The most obvious kind, the kind you first learn, are n squared. That means if you have 100 elements, it's going to take on the order of 100 squared to do it. So doubling the size of something quadruples the amount of time it's going to need to do it. N log n says it's going to take n, and then it's going to take a logarithmic factor. But the logarithmic factor goes much more slowly. So the log to the base 2 of 100 is way less than 100. So in that particular case, you get the bigger the data you work on, the bigger the advantage is. And it turns out there are lots of other algorithms that have these various properties, or a less obvious algorithm is way faster. So it turns out that knowing the right algorithm can certainly be handy too. All we're doing in this case is implementing the basic language in such a way that it fits into the basic underlying JVM well, and it has this cute idea of short-circuiting that I've been talking about, or short-cutting, again, which I think is a better term. So we got what looks like this humongous expression. Now, let me write this thing down. And obviously, I wrote this so I could show the various components and how they worked. So first I check, is A greater than 0? And or if it's not greater than 0, I have to check whether B is less than 0. And it's also the case that C is equal to 10. Oops. And I chose that because that means it has both the and or operators and has a variety of relational operators. So now we're going to do the relational operators in jump code form. As I've been suggesting, this fits in to the form of for short-circuiting. And let's look at the short-circuiting thing, and we'll put this in the context of an if. So the notion is we want to get out of this humongous expression as quickly as we can. We're kind of neutral. We don't really much care if it's true or false, but we want to figure out if it's true, go to the then part, if it's false, go to the else part, and get there as soon as possible. So what we're going to do in this particular case is we're first going to evaluate this in short circuit form and also, of course, in jump code form. So let's go and look at the code we do on this. So in this particular case, let's look at this. It says, remember, this is an OR. And an OR says if something, the first operand is true, I know the whole expression is true. So I've got a chance to go to the then part. Immediately that I can figure out that A greater than 0 is true. So this is one of those cases here where I want to jump out of this tangle of code doing all these compares and conditionals down to the then part or the else part. That's my goal. Once I get to the then part or the else part, that's like getting to gate 1 or gate 2 of the facility here and you're just about home or ready to go to work. So in this case, we're going to do that. We're going to say we're going to load A onto the stack. And remember, we have 0. So I can do this special trick that if I'm comparing against 0, these special operands. You wouldn't need to do it this way, but I'm just showing the full power here. So you have something that says, if A is greater than 0. So it says, if A is greater than 0, I'm going to go to L1. So if A is going to greater than 0, that's jump if true. If this is true, I'm out of this conditional expression immediately, and I go straight to the then part, and the L1 I go to is the label on the then part. So look at this thing. So we've got this humongous expression, and all I need to do is two instructions, and maybe I'm out of there. I got to load the operand, the A, and test whether it's got the special value I want, namely it's greater than 0. So it says greater than, and if you don't say what value it's greater than, it defaults to 0. You can push the other operand in and do a full compare if you need to. So in that particular case, you go out there, and therefore, I don't know if you consider it 50-50, but there's a 50% chance that I'm out of there in two instructions. Now, I don't know if it's 50-50 chance that is greater than or not, but just given that I have two options, the one option got me out straight away. So what happens is if I did this jump, if true, so the rule is if it's false, I continue on. So it says, okay, now what I need to do is evaluate the other operand of the OR. And again, if that's true, the whole thing will be true and I go to the then part. If it's false, I go to the else part. So I go into and I say, what happens in and? So I go down here. So I say, in this particular case, if I know the and is false, I know the whole expression is false, and if the whole expression is false, then the Boolean is false, and therefore I want to jump to the else part. So in this particular case, it says, if this is the opposite of less than, because in this case I want to jump, if the opposite is true, I'm going to jump to the else part if this is false. So what's the opposite of less than? The complement, I should say, and is greater than or equal. So if B is greater than or equal to zero, that is false. This expression is false. It's true if it's less than, false if it's greater than or equal. But if this guy is false, the whole expression is false, and therefore I want to jump to the else part. So the else part is labeled F. And I don't know, F, I guess, is for false. I had L1, N2, and I just didn't want to do L3. So whatever the label, oops, sorry. So in that particular case. But now look, in this particular case, I've done just two more instructions, loaded a variable and did another conditional branch, and I'm potentially out of there again. Failing that, I have one last thing to test. If it's equal, then in that particular case, this whole thing will be true and I'll go to the then part. Otherwise, it's false and I go to the else part. So in this case, I got to compare 10 because it's not zero anymore. So this BI is pushed, byte immediate push. So it's pushing a byte, as you know, it's small enough that it fits in there. And it says, again, I'm comparing equal, but I want to do a false branch. So I do the complement of equal, which is not equal. And it says if it's not equal, this guy is false, and I go to the else part. Otherwise, I fall through, and I'm in the then part. So these instructions up here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of them, are able to implement what looks like a fairly complex expression. In fact, it is, because it's got three different compares and two different Boolean operators. And a mere fact, you can get by with 7 instructions seems to me to be a very elegant translation. And again, the situation in the average, again, you'd have to have some sort of probabilities of when things are true and false. But on average, you're going to execute fewer than 7, because in some cases, you do the first evaluation, you're out of there. Other cases, you get to the second and you're out of there. And it's only to the third that you have to do the full evaluation. So on average, it's probably going to be 3 or 4 instructions to evaluate that whole conditional. So it turns out some cleverness here can really get you a nice implementation, and it fits in very nicely with the jump code form. What I skipped over, let me just do it without the notes. One of the things you say is, well, wait a minute. If it's the case that I really want to have something in the old-fashioned form, not the jump code form, but the old-fashioned operand form, am I stuck? And the answer turns out it's not. There are conversion paths in both directions. So if you have something translated in jump code form, and you say, I have to have a Boolean. Why is that? Well, you might have something like B equals this whole monster here. You know, the A greater than zero or blah, blah, blah. And you really want to store that away. That's probably not too common, but it certainly is legal. How do you do this? Well, you generate this whole thing in jump code form, and you essentially make this a conditional expression. Remember, conditional expressions are like conditional statements. So effectively, it says, if this guy is true, then you want to go ahead and push a 1, else you push a 0. Which is kind of what we were doing early on when we did the relationals and pushing it on. So if you have something translated in jump code form, you say, darn, I really want a Boolean value to do an assignment or perhaps pass as a parameter or something, you can do it. On the other hand, if you have something in Boolean form, you can change it into jump code form real easy. That's essentially what you do when you do an if statement. So if I had something that was in Boolean form, and I wanted to, in operand form, and I want to do it, I would simply say if, and this is the Boolean value. Remember, you push this onto the stack. And in this particular case, if it's true, so if this is true, I say go to the true label, else go to the false label. And if you wanted to, you could even negate the B and get it the other way around. So the takeaway on this little snippet is you make one choice or another, and you try to do the one which normally is going to be more useful. I think in the case of Boolean operators and in the case of relational operators, it turns out that doing jump code form is the better of the two, simply because they're more likely to be used to control a loop or control a conditional than to pass a parameter or store a variable or whatever. So it fits your perceived need better. Okay, one other thing I wanted to mention, and I skipped over, so let's do that, is that not only is short-circuiting an optimization, sometimes it's a flat-out necessity if you want to have the program work correctly. If you rely on the fact that the short-circuited operators are defined as I showed previously, namely that you only evaluate the second operand if you have to. If the first operand is enough to tell you the answer, skip it. That means you can write code like this. And it's really not bad code at all, and it does exist in real programs, where the second operand will fail, get a runtime error, if the first operand, it would fail, but we know the short circuiting means it'll be avoided. So this is the traditional example. If A is not equal to 0, then you can safely do a divide. And only do the divide if the thing is not equal to 0. If it is equal to 0, that is, in that particular case, if it's not equal to 0, if it's not equal to 0, then, you got that backwards? So in this particular case, I only want to do the second operand if I know for sure that the value is not equal to 0. If it was equal to 0, the divide would be fatal. So we want to make sure we have that handled. So that's an overview situation. I didn't want to go into too much detail on it because it's not something required in your project. But it is something I wanted you to know about, and certainly something that I think would, in a more robust and a more complete compiler, more likely appear. So I had one other thing I wanted to talk about, and then we'll be ready to go on and talk about the exams, is I talked about for loops. And you say to yourself, for loops are there, but that's not what I really use in practice. What I really use much more often, talk about while loops, but what you really use much more often is for loops. And the point I want to make here is that for loops really are just while loops with a tiny little bit of stuff added. So in this particular case, we have a for loop, and this doesn't even have a label. You could add a label and have a fifth subtree. That would have made drawing it just way more complex than I wanted to do. So in this particular case, we have an initializer, and the initializer tells you what the initial value is, of course. We have a condition, that's the same thing as a while. We have an increment that's executed at the end of each iteration, and we have a loop body. So the code we're going to generate for this for loop is going to look a lot like a while loop. It says we're going to put the initialization up code up top, because it's only evaluated once. Then we're going to go ahead and do a go to. We're going to go to the bottom because normally the condition is tested at the bottom of the loop. So we're going to skip around the body of the loop only the first time. In that case, evaluate the condition. And if the condition is false, that means we don't want to terminate. We're going to go back and, in this case, execute the body. Normally, after we execute the body, we'll do an increment. And after we do the increment, we then do the test. So that's the way we implement it. And Let's see. Just about out of time. So let me, in this case, take a break here, and we'll pick it up then after the first break. And in this particular case, we'll talk a little bit about this and answer questions. So we'll see you then about 4:15.